Well, this week we're going to start in Exodus 14, verse 10. But before we get into that very far, and I made a mistake with my notes, and I fixed it, but I had a note that I thought was on the first page, and it's not. Here it is. Last week, Numbers 33:7 kind of came up because in it it talked about being east of the point in the north. Anyway, there's a reference to east in that verse, and the question came up, well, why did this one version have it and none of the others did? And when I looked up the word in the reference material, the word doesn't really have anything to do with east, so that would have been an interpolation or an interpretation made by the translators that's where they would have been east. So just kind of clear that up a little bit. I think we pretty much knew that because every version of the scriptures we looked at in here, save one, did not use the word east, but just said near. So I think that was probably already cleared up, but I did look it up. So last time we saw God led the people from Egypt after the Passover. He took a less direct route to Canaan. He took them, instead of going right up through the area of the Philistines, they went through the wilderness on the way to the sea, the wilderness in the direction of the sea. And we get God's thoughts behind that. So not always does God give us his thoughts behind what he's thinking when he does things, but he said he led them away from that direct route because he was reckoning that if they got involved in war too quickly, that they would be appalled by that, or be that would cause them to turn back. And so they left Succoth in military formation on their way to Etham and toward the Gulf of Aqaba on the edge of the wilderness. And so I handed out the maps last time. There should be plenty if you didn't get one. And Succoth and Etham are both a little bit arbitrary in where I put them on there. We don't know exactly where they were, but we got a pretty good idea where Etham was, or Etham, however you want to say that, in that was a common campground area. So it was almost certainly in that area just north west of the upper tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And so that's where they went. We found out that Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. That was a promise made by Joseph's brothers, that he would be taken, his bones would be taken back and put in the family plot at Canaan. The Lord led, it said, by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, and that fire was, one of its purposes was to provide light for travel. We've got a lot of people, that's a lot of light. And it said that these pillars were not taken away, which really negates some of the folks that want to say it had to be some sort of a fog or some sort of a natural fog or something to do with volcanoes, that you got to have volcanoes in the area or you don't get the pillar of fire. That's really not the way it worked at all, and we're going to see that even more pointedly today. So when they were ready to depart from Adam, God said, make a turn. And he turned them south. And they would go through the Wadi of Atir, which is a narrow canyon that was there for about a half of their 67-mile journey to the beachhead at the modern city of Nuevo. And when they get to the beach, a wadi will turn them toward the coast. So there's a little turn at the end. And so when they get there, they're at a camp facing that Wadi of Atir, also facing the mountains to the west. And so they're camped there facing west. Now, God told Moses his reason for taking people down this path. Do you remember what that was? Why did God take Moses and the Israelites down to this beachhead? What's that?
So that the Egyptians
Yeah, it's for his purposes that he can glorify himself and show the Egyptians that he truly is God. He said in there, quoting, "I will be honored." And so God says, and he will harden Pharaoh's hearts. Well, after they've gone, Pharaoh and his servants indeed regret letting the Israelites go. And so Pharaoh led them to make great readiness, put all their chariots together and their armies together and all their battlements together, and off they went. And after they had departed, then the scriptures tell us that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart as he was chasing these Israelites across the countryside. And sure enough, Pharaoh did chase them right down to the beach. And in verse 9, where we quit last time, we see that Pharaoh and all of his might, his horses, his chariots, his horsemen, and his army have overtaken them as they're camped by the sea, and that's where they are. So let's pick it up. First, we're going to read verses 10 through 12 in chapter 14 of Exodus. And it says, "As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they became very frightened, so that the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, 'Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, "Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians"? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And so here we are. The Israelites look out there to the west and they see this Egyptian army, and they are indeed trapped. Their only way of escape would have been back up the Wadi of Atir. That wadi is closed off because it's full of the Egyptians and his army. And so in verse 10, Pharaoh approached, and when the Israelites see them, they were very frightened, the scriptures tell us. Would they have reason for fear at this point? What's that?
Apart from an understanding of the supernatural working of God, yeah, they have all the reasons to fear.
They have a lot of reasons for fear, and interestingly enough, at least in terms of what's recorded, God told Moses what he's doing, but Moses didn't tell the people. And so here they are, and you know, we think of that. And there's one thing about the changes in time and the resources that are available to us. If you got 600,000 people that you're leading around, now God's doing the leading through the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, right? But if you want to tell 600,000 people, men and their then their adjoining families, something, how do you do that? I mean, just stop and think about that a minute. We're going to start marching today, and somehow I want to communicate something to everybody. And we've got a million plus people to communicate with. I mean, you don't have a loudspeaker. You can't put it on the radio. Certainly not calling cell phones. I mean, so it would have been a little bit of a challenge. And but here are the people, and they're looking at the armies of Egypt. Now, another thing to keep in mind, they went out, the Israelites went out in military formation. So they've got 600,000 men that have gone that are what Israel would consider their most likely soldiers. Are they going to be any match for Pharaoh? No. Pharaoh's got chariots. They've got horsemen. They're probably battle-hardened. They know what to do. Israel's been making bricks. And so there they are as Israelites. Yes, they know who would be their fighting men, but it's not even going to be a good fight. And so it also says there in verse 10, "And the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord." Don't know what that cry, what the content of that was. Don't know if that was wailing. Don't know if that was prayers. Don't know really what it was, but they cried out to God. But then they turned directly to Moses. And it shows a little bit what they expect out of God, which is not much. They turned to Moses and said, "Were there not enough graves in Egypt? You had to bring us out here to die. their whole attitude is, what did you do to us? And why have you dealt with us in this way? There's an implication there that he have put them in a place that they would not willingly go, maybe through trickery or deception, at least through leading them somewhere they didn't want to go, and that's further emphasized in verse 12. Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone, that we can serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Let's go look at a couple passages. Go back to Exodus 5:21. In Exodus 5:21, there's been some communication with the descendants of Abraham, but pretty much in this particular instance, God has sent Moses to Pharaoh and said, let the people go out and worship. We're going to go in the wilderness and we're going to worship. And there's a reply that comes from Pharaoh. Do you remember in general what the content of that was? What did Pharaoh do when Moses said, hey, you need to let these people, let us go worship in the wilderness. God has directed me to come to you to tell you to let us do that. What did they respond with? Testing your memory a little bit.
You've made us a stink in Pharaoh's eyes.
Well, it made a stink in Pharaoh's eyes, but what did Pharaoh respond with? Oh, so you've got time to go worship, do you? You have to make just as many bricks, but we're not bringing the straw anymore. And they really, really tried to put them down with hard work. This is their reply to Moses. That's not chapter 5. Go over here. Chapter 5. And they said, this is the people saying to Moses, look, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants and put a sword in their hand to kill us. Did they appreciate Moses' request that they could go out and worship in the wilderness? No. Look at what happened. And, of course, Moses then turns to God and said, hey, Lord, I'm not sure what to do with this. This doesn't seem like what we were trying for. And he says, why have you brought harm to the people? And so on. It doesn't necessarily end there. Another example is in chapter 6, verse 9. Turn over there. In chapter 6, verse 9, Moses is talking to the people about making the trek to the promised land. So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. So Moses didn't exactly bond with them very well. And they were spared many of the plagues. And God took good care of them. They should have been able to see that. But when we get here to the beach on the Gulf of Aqaba and they see all those soldiers, they go back to where they were in the beginning. What did you do to us? Now, they've already experienced the plagues. They've experienced the Passover. They've been given the celebrations. Those things just don't mean much when faced with the fear of death and the armies out there. So, in our vernacular, why did you butt in? We were better off without your meddling. What? And we've already kind of said a little bit, but what were the Israelites missing here? Well, they didn't have a temple yet, but what were they short as far as information to understand what's going to happen here? They had no expectations of delivery, it doesn't sound like, does it? And should they have had expectations of delivery?
They just miraculously plundered the Egyptians. Like, the Egyptians gave them gold and silver on their way out. They just watched the firstborn die, you know, of everyone who wasn't in the covenant community. Like, they just saw all of these miraculous things happen that got them to get out of Egypt. And it's just interesting to see how quickly they forget these miraculous signs and just focus on what they see and the reality that they're existing and not understanding the reality.
So they knew the power of God at this point, at least to an extent, because of what you just said. They also knew that God wanted them out of Egypt, didn't he? I mean, when the time came, who was speaking the loudest about get out of Egypt? The Egyptians. Get out of here. We're all going to die if you stay. So they were persona non grata in Egypt. God has pushed them out. God has done miracles to get them out. And they've seen these miracles occur. And it's also been taught to them about all of that through the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Passover celebration that's been established. And the constant words are, God took us out of slavery by his mighty hand. There's a little more they should have been thinking about. What do they have with them? What did Moses grab before they left? What's that?
The Ark of the Covenant.
No, it didn't have an ark yet. That's yet to come in history. I'm looking for Joseph's bones. Now, they've got Joseph's bones with them. Why did they have Joseph's bones with them? That was the promise. But why did Joseph exact the promise?
So that they would go back home.
Well, Joseph exacted the promise, not saying if you go, but when you go. And Joseph believed that. Why?
Because of the Abrahamic covenant that God had given.
Abraham, wander throughout the land. I'm going to give it all to you. Jacob, or Isaac first, wander throughout the land. I'm going to give it all to you. Jacob, wander through the land. I'm going to give it all to you. And in all cases, and I'm going to make you a great nation. And then Jacob got one last promise. Don't be afraid to go to Egypt. I'm going to bring you out. Now, it's going to be a while. They're going to be in slavery, but he's going to bring them out. So they've seen miracles, and they've got truth. The truth of the promises, the handed down expectations, and even here's Moses that went after the bones to take the bones of Joseph on the trip to the promised land because Joseph had made him make the promise because he knew it was going to happen. So what's the lesson in this part of our study today for us?
Believe in the promises.
Yeah, there's promises. Do we have just a few? I mean, we've got promises that I will guarantee you if you ask me to sit down and make a list of the things God has promised for people that will follow him, for people that believe in Christ, I'd do a terrible job. I'd get some out there, but I would have a tough time getting them all out, and I would guess you would too. And that's to our detriment. There's a song, Standing on the Promises. It's an old one. But that's really where we stand. It's on the promise of Christ that I will come back and get you. It's one of those promises that he made to the apostles while he was still here. Then the time of his coming back to get those that are following him is still out there. But many other promises about moving from death to life, about no judgment for those who are in Christ. I mean, you can just keep on going with the promises, and they're there. Have we had the power of God demonstrated to us? In what ways?
Even more supremely than the parting of the Red Sea or the destruction of the Egyptian army, like Christ has come and defeated sin for us on our behalf. So,
Resurrection? I mean, we certainly could look at some ancient promises. Jesus made a declaration that unless a man be born again, he cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Has anybody been born again? I mean, that's a miracle. That's a change internal to us that we should be very mindful of. For some of us, it probably had some dramatic elements to it. I was caught up in this, and God took that away. For some of us, it might be a much more simple story of how God has changed our lives through being born again and the sanctification that comes out of that, and the growth and the truth and the care that God gives us and his providential work in our lives. But the day may come when we face the equivalent of that army. And so we may have reason for great physical fear for our own lives. Who knows? I'm not saying it's going to happen in your lifetime or mine, but we can certainly see the foundations by which it could come as we are unwilling to accept the paths that the world wants to give us to endorse. And so we should have those things in our minds. Here's another thing that is, I just love this contrast. Go over to Isaiah chapter 5. Acts chapter 5. We're going to look at a few verses over there that are at the conclusion of some events early in the life of the church. And what we have is that the apostles, shortly after the sermon in Pentecost, are preaching Christ in the temple. And it's not well received. They are jailed for doing so. And they are miraculously released. And so the leaders of the Jews believe that these men are incarcerated, and servants come in to say, you know those guys that you picked up yesterday that we had down in the jail? Yeah, they're in the temple preaching. That's right what they did. They went right back to it. So they are recaptured. They're brought in front of the council. The council wants to kill them. They're mad. How dare you defy us in this way? And they are murderous in their thoughts. But Mr. Gamaliel speaks up and says, no. This is not a good plan. If this is not of God, it will die out quickly. But if it is of God, your opposition to it will mean your demise instead of theirs. Which, by the way, in the short term, that's not a good plan. We've got a lot of false religions that have been around for centuries, right? In the long term, that's going to work. But in the short term, you can't say, well, if it lasts a long time, then it's of God. But at any rate, that's the advice they're given, so they agree to not put them to death. And instead, they are beaten. And I want to look down starting in verse 40. We're going to read 40, 41, and 42. And it says, they took his advice. That's the Jewish council. And after calling the apostles in, they flogged them and ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and then released them. So they went on their way from the presence of the council. And these are key words, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. And every day in the temple and from house to house, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as Christ. This is an attitude these people lacked. They're there on the Gulf of Aqaba, on that sandy beachhead camping, and they see these Egyptians, and they're mad because they might die. They didn't look at it and say, God always glorifies himself. God's purposes are always met. If it serves the kingdom of God for me to suffer and die, so be it. Glad to be counted worthy to serve God through my death. See how different that is when you get the apostles and they're spirit-led instead of these people that are focused on who they are in this physical life. So there's an attitude that we were able to see modeled for us by the apostles that we ought to be thinking about putting into our own lives when we face these kinds of hardships or punishments from the world. And so, questions, comments? Yes.
And, you know, they just had the law at that time.
Well, they didn't even have the law like we're thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, God had given some laws. That's true.
Yeah.
But the law that will come out of Moses isn't there yet. Yeah, go ahead.
And so I guess in my mind, the gift of the Bible and stuff and everything that's presented to us that we can read and have that knowledge and everything mm-hmm. that took place is so beneficial to our walk and to our faith that they didn't have any of that stuff, and communication and stuff was so, backwards at that time, it's
mm-hmm.
it's just so different, and they didn't, they had God, but and Moses and people to, and the disciples to lead them and stuff, but they didn't have Christ,
Well,
they didn't know
certainly.
That. So their faith was.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. What should I say? Their faith. I don't know. You want to say their weak of faith? They didn't see the human Christ who sacrificed himself. So.
Well, we certainly have some great advantages.
Yeah.
And shame on us if we don't take. And put those advantages into our lives. But they also had something we didn't have, we don't have, at least not from the same source. Because let's go back and think about Joseph for a minute. Joseph was pursued for sin, right? Potiphar's wife went after him. And he said, how could I dishonor my Lord this way? See, Joseph suffered. He was taken into slavery. Joseph is one of my heroes of the faith. One of the big reasons why is he endured some really harsh, unfair things on his way to becoming the leader that God promised him he would be. And there is nothing recorded about him lashing out, about him being angry with God. He didn't badmouth God. He didn't go, what went wrong with the plan? He just endured. He did tell one of the men, the cupbearer, I shouldn't be here in prison. So when you get into Pharaoh's presence, see if you can get me some justice. He did do that. So he was very much aware of the injustice. But what they had was, they were descendants of Abraham. And while Jesus puts that down correctly, because when Jesus is here, he says, if the Son sets you free, then you're free indeed. And they go, whoa, stop. We're already free. We're not slaves of anybody. We're children of Abraham. And Jesus says, no, you're not. You don't act like Abraham. Your behavior is the opposite of Abraham. Abraham saw this day and rejoiced. Abraham wanted it, but you, as children of Abraham, are really slaves of Satan because of your sin. He who sins is a slave to sin. So we might say, well, being a child of Abraham is not that helpful, but in reality, it should have been to them. That was their main heritage. God made a promise to Abraham that he's fulfilling in our day. And we're grafted in. And we definitely belong in Christ, and we should have that same sense of belonging. As a matter of fact, in Ephesians, it says that as grafted in ones, we are now children of the promise, equal to the children of Abraham. So we have it, but they had it through a promise and a bloodline and something they should have been really expecting. And the old phrase, somebody rolling over in a grave, I have to think Abraham was rather a bit disturbed by the reaction of these Israelite children if he was made aware of it and where he was in the afterlife. But so I'm not really disagreeing with you. We've got a ton of stuff. We can see so much looking backwards through Christ that they couldn't see even looking forward for Christ. But They did have something that should have carried them through this moment, I think.
They had all seen some stuff.
Well, and they had seen directly yeah.
They were direct observers of the 10 plagues. They were direct observers of the pillars of fire and the pillars of smoke. So what do you do with these actual physical representations that don't somehow get through to you, that God's in control.
By the way, while those plagues were going on, what was the clear battle? Who were the key players in the confrontation? Who's been confronting who?
Yahweh versus the gods of the Egyptians.
Yahweh versus the god of the Egyptians, and the god of the Egyptians was represented by Pharaoh, and the god of the Israelites was being spoken for on behalf of by Moses, but God was representing himself, right? I mean, he did the miracles where you could see him. And so you've got this very visible presence of God's actions in Egypt. Look at this line that the Israelites say there on the shore. In Egypt, we said, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. I'm fairly confident. It's an intuitive statement that they weren't thinking about the question I'm going to ask you. But when they said that, which God were they choosing? The Egyptian God. They were saying, we would have been better off to have been with the Egyptians, following the God of the gods of the Egyptians, than to be here on the shore of the Gulf of Aqaba, following Yahweh. That's a pretty condemning statement for themselves. So I missed another. Was there something else we needed to say in here?
And the pillar that God provided for him was still there on the beach. Yes.
Yes. No. The pillar was never taken away. The pillars. I mean, at one point we're going to see it as a singular pillar doing two things. But I have some questions. Yes.
History is an interesting thing. One of the exoduses that made this pale by comparison was a term called manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. Our manifest destiny was to move all the Indians somewhere else down the Trail of Tears, even after some of them converted to Christianity, to places like the Indian Territory. It went from 56 million to 6 million. And it was a huge exodus compared to this one. Huge.
Mm-hmm.
But it was indeed an exodus, and it was proclaimed by God through manifest destiny.
Well, it was supposedly, I'm going to use the word supreme. I mean, they said God has put us in this superior position. I mean, there's a whole lot wrong with many of the attitudes that settlers came over with.
That's right. That's
but nonetheless, yeah, that was there. Well, let's take a look at Exodus 14. Beginning in verse 13 through the end of the chapter, and I'm just going to read it, and then we're going to go back and make some comments. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. The angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land so that the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. at the morning which the at the morning watch the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty, so that the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them, and on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used among the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. We've heard the key elements of that account many times. If you grew up in the church environment, it's one of the key accounts that we bring to children. And so there, most of these details you've heard, but there's some things we really would benefit to look at. It starts out with Moses saying, "Don't fear." Now, God has not yet given Moses the command to part the sea or start the parting of the sea by lifting his staff or his hand and staff. But he says, "Don't fear. Stand by, wait, and see the salvation which the Lord will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians you've seen today, you will never see them again forever." So how did Moses know that? We don't have anything recorded where God had said they're all going to die today. But Moses, in some fashion, did know that. I think verse 14 is more loaded than we might first think. "The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." I think there's a bit of a command in here. Lord's going to fight for you. Now shut up. Quit proclaiming your fear. Quit woe is me stuff. Lord's going to fight for you. Be quiet. Watch. See what he's going to do. And then God almost chastises Moses, the way it's translated into English anyway. "Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward.'" Which way is forward? Toward the water. "As for you, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on what?" And I know you've heard this 100 times, but has anybody in here ever been where water has receded? Can you walk through that? Sometimes you can, but most of the time, if you do try to walk through it, you're going to be up to your knees or something like that in mud. But God brings them through with an opportunity to walk on dry land. And so probably hard dry land is a fair thing to think here. They had a walking path. It would work. Now, God says, "By the way, I've got a task I'm going to do here too. For behold, I'm going to harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so they're going to go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and his all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. And then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh and through his chariots and through his horsemen." How's God going to honor himself? What's he going to do that honors him? What?
He's going to overpower
him. He's going to overpower him. He's going to destroy him. That's a simple way of saying it. I'm taking them out, and Egypt is going to know I am God. When we look, I right now, I wish I'd have looked it back up, but when we were going through the videos, one of the hieroglyphs was how Egypt was taken over by the Hyksos, and there wasn't even a battle. Why wasn't there a battle? They had no army, and the Hyksos were hard on them, and even in the hieroglyph Egyptian record, they said it was a punishment from God, singular. The angel of God then had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So these pillars that they were used to moved between them and the Egyptians, because behind isn't the direction they were facing when they're camped. Behind is the direction that they were leaving and going from. And it says it was the angel of God. We know from other language, that's the same language we see at the burning bush. And at the burning bush, the same name for the Lord here, for the angel, that same phrase. At the burning bush, who was there? Take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. Who shall I say has sent me? I am. And so this is Jehovah. And this power pillar arrangement, apparently both of the cloud and the night came, and the fire came together. And so you've got darkness, you've got cloudiness, and you've got light there. The light helped the Israelites, I'm sure. But Israel did not wind up in Egypt. They did not keep coming near one another all night. How do lights work for you when you're in a fog? Are they a plus or a minus? Depends. But most of the time, those lights tend to shine out in ways that make it hard to see much of anything. And so this is what the Egyptians are facing. They've got a cloud, which is like a fog, and they've got this light there, and they can't see to do anything. The Israelites are going to move out here at night. And so Moses did stretch out his hand as he was told to do. And the waters are parted. They're like walls on each side. It's accompanied by an east wind. We ought to talk about that again. See if you, those of you that were here previously on the videos, it says here that this is a common translation. Many will have similar translations. The Lord swept the sea back, swept the sea by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. The way it gets done in English, that sounds like the tool that was used was the wind. But if you go back and look at the language, it really says accompanied by a wind. God did absolutely bring a wind, but it wasn't a wind adequate to separate the seas. That was done by God's miracle. And we get to east wind. That term east there can be used either from a direction or in the direction of. And almost certainly it's in the direction toward the east. So it's moving eastward, not like we would say an east wind coming out of the east. Why do we say that? That's going to be helpful to the Israelites. They're going to have a tailwind. They're going to have this strong wind helping them in their effort to move across the dry land to the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. So in verse 22, the sons of Israel went through in the midst of the sea. They had the walls on the right and the left. And so Israel is at least most of the way through, or all the way through, and we see that Pharaoh and his army then pursue them into the midst of the sea. In verse 24, it says at the morning watch. Those are terms that just mean at daybreak time, okay? It could have been translated that way, but often in the use said morning watch. But the Lord looked down. Now, that's an interesting phrase. He looked through the pillar of fire and cloud, which also gives us some information about these pillars. They weren't head high. And the word pillar would indicate some height, but he's looking down through these and he sees what's going on. And it says, he brought the army of Egypt into confusion. And here's something that I don't remember from the childhood accounts, but maybe that was there. But he started making it difficult for them. Their chariot wheels began to swerve. They weren't staying true and straight on the axle. And made it difficult for them to drive. They just couldn't seem to get things to go where they wanted it to go. So what's the response of the Egyptians to that?
To flee from Israel.
God, they knew who God was, didn't they? They lived through the plagues. Yahweh is fighting for Israel. Effectively, let's get out of here. The Lord is on the side of Israel. He's fighting for them. And then God tells Moses, stretch out your hand again so the waters will cover the Egyptians and their weapons of war. And he stretched out his hand, and the sea returned to normalcy at daybreak. And the Egyptians, now this is interesting, were fleeing right into it. How far did the Egyptians get in their attempt to cross the same way that the Israelites had gone? Did they get clear to the other side? Well, I've always believed that. It's possible that when they turned around to flee, some of them were truly over there. Because of the way this is worded there in verse 27, it says the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Now, maybe they weren't out of the water, but they were fleeing into this sea as it came back over the top of them. And it really probably doesn't matter how far they got, but certainly they didn't get far enough to truly do any harm to the Israelites, and they were back in the sea or in the sea when the sea went back to normal, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the sea. Water covered them all. Not one remained. Nobody escaped to go home and say, just a second, Bill. Nobody got to go home and say, you wouldn't believe what happened. They just never came home. Yeah, Bill.
What we're talking about is not so unusual when you think about at high and low tides, twice a year, you can walk hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards into the ocean and pick up razor clams. And the other phenomena that this happens is tsunamis.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, it'll, the water will recede and then come back.
There will be no water for hundreds of yards out.
So
that wall comes back in.
So what's the question, though, in this case, what caused it? Was it a tsunami? Was it... Yeah. Yeah.
It's not an unusual fact.
It happens. So here's a contrast. The Israelites walked through on dry land with water, with walls of water on each side. And the Lord saved Israel that day from the Egyptians. But the contrast is the Israelites got to see the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And so it's, excuse me. Quite a contrast here. When Israel saw the great power of the Lord that was used to wipe out the Egyptians, what did they do? What's their response? You can look down there in verse 31.
They feared and believed.
They feared and believed God and Moses. So, what was God's stated purpose in having the Egyptians pursue the Israelites, and then all of these events that we see? What did God say was his reason for doing it?
To be glorified.
What's that? To be glorified?
And that the Egyptians would know.
So the Egyptians would know, I am God. But as the Egyptians learned, who else got the same lesson?
The
Imagine the contrast from how they felt on the beachhead at Nuevo, on that sandbar there, versus after they got across. When they're on the sandbar, it's, you brought us out here to die. What's wrong with you, Moses? Wouldn't you listen to us? We said we want to just be left alone in Egypt. And now, did they fear God? No, they feared Egyptians. Now they fear God. They recognize that the power of God has to be dealt with soberly. They dare not go against God. And who's representing God? Who's speaking to them on behalf of God? Moses. Has Moses let them down once yet? Well, they might say, yeah, because he caused a lot of trouble. But the trouble ultimately ended up with them on across the sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, on dry ground, not only having completely plundered the Egyptians, but now destroyed the Egyptians, the mightiest army in the world. They were the equivalent of a superpower in their time. So this is the first time in Exodus, I went out and searched for this, that the fear of the Lord is mentioned concerning Israel. The first time in Exodus, you see the people being given credit for fearing God. There were other times that God was feared, but it wasn't the Israelites. And so this is where it takes us. I want to take just a minute, because if you were at the, when we did the videos, you saw this. Now I can't find it. Maybe it's over here. I kept one for me. You heard this, but I wanted to give it to you in a form you could help remember some details, and I don't have it. I'll just go back and grab it here. Thank you. There are some things about this crossing to realize. Now, I want to start out by saying we don't have very absolutely certain or great information about the topography of the land under the water on the Sea of Aqaba. The last survey that was done that the Western world has access to was done in the year 2000, and it looked good, but even the people that want to say these things are true will say very quickly, this is the best information we have. So just say that in that way. But if we look at the place where the crossing occurred, we believe at the modern Nuweiba Beach is the starting point. Across the Sea of Aqaba, it's 9.7 miles from shore to shore. In the deepest part, somewhat toward the center of this crossing, they're going to be 2,800 feet deep, deeper than they were on either shore. So when they're at the lowest point of their crossing, the water is about 2,800 feet high on each side of them. That's pretty amazing. There is a plateau in the crossing. It doesn't start out there. It goes down and then it widens out and then it stays fairly wide and then narrows back up on the other side. But in the main part of the crossing, there's a plateau that runs north-south. So as they're crossing, they've got about a 5 mile wide, it's less than five, but not a lot less than 5 mile, mile long or wide stretch that they can walk on. So they can kind of spread out as they're going across. The beachhead that they left from is a little more than 5 miles wide, and it covers about 8 square miles where they were probably doing the camping. So it's a little over a mile in east-west dimension, probably about a mile and a half, and about 5 miles in the north-south dimension. The downslope leaving the beach is about 10.5%, for those of you that think in percents of rises and falls, or 6 degrees if you want to think about degrees on a compass. The upslope on the other side is about 13%, or 7.4 degrees. Now, to contrast that, the interstate highway system has slopes of about 10.5% to 12.3%, or 6 to 7 degrees. Not far off of any of the slopes we see here. Wheelchair ramps are allowed 12.5%, or about a little over 7 degrees for inclines. When the nation goes and builds a park, in the urban parks, they're allowed slopes of 10% or 6 degrees. If they're in a primitive area, they get 15% or 9 degrees for slopes. So this is for your tourists to go walking around inside the park. And so you can see that the numbers that were given here are not at all unreasonable numbers to make a walking trip across this Gulf of Aqaba at this point. Even in some of the pretty shallow spots on the northern and southern portions of the Gulf, or frankly anywhere else in the Gulf, could you walk across like this? If you just parted the water and dried the ground as God did for them at this crossing point, even though it's shallower, there's some point where you go down almost a cliff or something like that. You've got some really big slopes that you'd have to try to scramble up and down, and you try to get that many people across the water with those kinds of slopes in there, it's not going to work out so well. So there's no other real site in the Gulf of Aqaba that this could occur. So just reminding you, that came from Dr. Glenn Fritz and Tim Mahoney, searching for the Red Sea crossing, that we did that video some weeks ago. Questions, comments?
That's a million, almost a million and a half people in 24 hours crossing 9 miles, and then, you know, and then, and again, we're talking not just people, we're talking carts and wagons and cattle and sheep. And
yep. You can, I mean, you can think about that a minute. I don't know what's an easy landmark that's 9 miles out, but it wouldn't be too far from going from the south edge of Emporia to almost, well, the airport's considered 4 miles south, so you'd be going to the chicken ranch down at Olpe, something like that. Could you walk that in a night? There are two things that you might think about to help you say, yeah, I could do that. One is, it makes a difference who's chasing you. Okay? You were motivated. But the other thing we cannot forget is, we tend to reduce all this to human terms. They've got God right there. And what things did God do that allowed them to make this trek and get it done in the time that was allotted? I don't know. Doesn't say, but you can be sure that if there was some supernatural intervention needed, he did it. And right out of the box, we've got one thing he did was, they didn't have to do it in the dark. They had the pillar of fire there to light their path. Dr. Glenn Fritz does say that if you were in the middle of the group, he's not sure, with it being nighttime and 5 miles, if you would see that 2,800-foot wall of water. And that's the only thing he said that I disagree with him. I can't imagine not being able to see. The furthest distance you'd be if it was a 5-mile path through there, you're 2.5 miles away. Could you see a skyscraper 2,500 foot tall? Yeah. Yeah, no problem. I think they probably were very much aware of that water as they.
And it wasn't just people crossing; they had their household.
Yeah, they were taking. They had everything loaded up, and away they went. So, God was with them. We can say that for sure. Well, that's what I've got for today. Next time, we'll move on to their trek on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba.